Court, Ms. Dawn Moore will argue for appellant, Mr. Charles Overton will argue for the state.
Good morning.
Morning.
As if you probably haven't had enough of hearing about this from the brief, but I really want to address a few things in points of error one and two relating to the court refusing to admit what it labeled hearsay testimony. And specifically, I want to respond to a few of the things that the state said in its brief. In doing so, I think that it might be more helpful to cage my response in relationship to the factors set forth by the United States Supreme Court and recited in Alonzo, which is all in the brief. And those factors, briefly, are the inherent trustworthiness of the hearsay, the corroborating evidence that the hearsay was truthful, that whether the hearsay was important to the determination of guilt or innocence, and the state's opportunity to examine the declarant of the hearsay, and the state's demonstration or lack of demonstration of the unreliability of the hearsay. And in particular, the state makes reference in its brief, for some reason I think I have page 13, although that doesn't sound right, that basically what they're saying is, we're going to say that this hearsay is not reliable because there was overwhelming evidence from state's witnesses to the contrary. And my problem with that is that's not the test for whether or not it's reliable. The fact that the state's witnesses say something different than what the defense witnesses say don't indicate that what the defense witnesses would have said would be unreliable. When we're trying to determine whether it's reliable, we look at the things surrounding that testimony. In this case in particular, the testimony that I'm referring to that I know the court is well aware of is the three eyewitnesses. I say three. I don't know that we actually know exactly how many, but it appears to be at least three eyewitnesses at the scene whose statements were not taken by the police officer. Those particular eyewitnesses were people that appeared to have observed what happened at the intersection at the time of the accident and waited around to talk to the police about what they saw. And for their service of waiting to talk to the police, they were summarily dismissed without any conversation. And it's the fact that they waited to talk, that it's obviously something that they had recently observed or that they could perhaps even have made some sort of excited utterance or present sense impression or contemporaneous outburst in relation to what they saw if they had been spoken to earlier or if they'd had an opportunity to speak at all. I think that's what we have to look at when we're trying to decide, is this reliable testimony? And also, are they neutral parties? I mean, these are just people off the street that saw it. There's no testimony that these were family members or someone with a motive, the insurance agent for Mr. Mull standing nearby who wanted to change up the testimony or what happened to benefit one of his clients. I mean, there's nothing that indicates there was any malintent or anything about these witnesses that would be that they were biased and unable to be neutral parties just saying what they saw. So first off, I do want to point out, I think that is not the right way to examine that. And then we look at one of the things I think that maybe the state's trying to get to is the corroborating evidence. And I will say that I do think there is other corroborating evidence to support these eyewitnesses, what we think that they would say based on what the police officer recited on the tape. And that is that the light was in fact yellow or yellow going to red and not red when Mr. Mole entered the intersection. And we do have Gloria Castillo's statement that it was turning to red, yellow turning to red. Now, she testified, and the state says that she was pretty clear that it was red when they entered the intersection. But one of the reasons why we take statements from people at the scene is because those statements tend to be what they observed at the time, and those are more reliable in and of themselves usually. And so the fact that the witness may have come and said something slightly different than what was in the statement doesn't mean that that testimony doesn't corroborate what the eyewitnesses says. It just means that the jury would have to judge the credibility of those things, whether they thought the witness was wrote down everything in the statement and changed it later. I mean, that's what the jury gets to do, is decide who told the truth, when, and what about. But I think it is some sort.
Really, we don't know what the other witnesses would have said. Really, the testimony we're talking about is testimony by the officers saying, these other people are there, what do you want me to do?
And actually, they say, the officer actually says, these other people are here, what do you want me to do with them? But he also says that, and I want to find it so I can tell you exactly, but he basically says, they say that the light was yellow turning to red. And I think what he did on the tape is even like, they say the light's yellow turning to red, and they say it was red. Well, you know how that goes. Like, you know, we always have contradictory evidence. And then he actually says something about, they don't seem to be that intelligent to me, referring to the people that say that the light was yellow turning to red. So the actual statement that indicates that those witnesses would have said something contrary to the witnesses who said the light was red is in the videotape. Now, we do have to believe that the officer is conveying that correctly, that, you know, he just heard that information.
Well, here's my question, because the way I've read the briefs without reading the record, of course, yet, is that the investigating officer just had a stack of affidavits and gave them to a witness and said, pass them out. So how do we know that, in fact, Mrs. Castillo, or in fact, some of the other people who filled out the affidavits weren't within the group that was supposedly saying that the light was yellow turning to red?
I'm sorry, you're saying how do we know that the people who filled out the affidavits weren't also the people who said the light was yellow turning to red?
Exactly. One of them being Mrs. Castillo, because that's what she put in her statement.
Sure.
And maybe the others, when they got down to writing the statement, said, maybe not. I mean, I'm just saying the record seems kind of murky as far as exactly, because the officer didn't say, these are the three people, their names are X, Y, and Z. I did not give them affidavits. And it didn't show that he gave any specific people affidavits. He just gave a stack to a bystander witness to distribute to whomever wanted to give a statement.
And actually, I mean, I completely understand that. I think that it is murky. That may be a good way to describe it. But when you look at the tapes and you listen to what the officers are saying to each other and the way that they're referring to the witnesses, and when you're able to review that evidence, I think that it clarifies a lot of it. And also, there is the officer's testimony. And actually, what he says is, at the beginning, I have people approaching me, and I'm trying to deal with the scene. Then I have people come up to me again. I'm like, look, you can get started. And he says he corrals all the witnesses that had come up to him at various times and said, go wait in this 7-Eleven parking lot. And the way that it's presented on the tape, when the officer is talking to Van Dyke being the trooper, I think it's Heinemeier, who was actually, I can't remember if it's Heinemeier or Vannucci, but I think it's Heinemeier, who is the one who the witnesses come up to begin with, and he gives the statements out. Or no, I'm sorry, it's Heinemeier. Vannucci's the one who gives the statements out. Heinemeier's the one standing at the scene with Van Dyke, who says, we still have these witnesses waiting. That is after, on the videotape, Van Dyke has already spoken to another group of witnesses, and he says, okay, I have your affidavits here. So I'm not saying it's impossible that one of those witnesses did give an affidavit, but because of the way that it transpires on the tape, it is very clear that the officer, Van Dyke, spoke with the witnesses who had been waiting, although he didn't really interview them exactly, but he spoke with them and said, all right, I got your statements here, you know, et cetera. And then after that is when Heinemeier says, we still have these other witnesses over here, and they were saying the light was yellow going to red. What do you want me to do with them? And so I think that it does clarify from looking at that, we are talking about other witnesses whose information was not taken. Additionally, you have Van Dyke saying in his testimony, and Heinemeier admitting that they didn't talk to all the eyewitnesses. Now, one of the problems that I have with that is the way that Van Dyke says it indicates that he didn't talk to any important witnesses, because he says, I spoke to all the witnesses that were waiting at the 7-Eleven. I didn't go walk the intersection randomly this is my word, randomly looking for, I think his word is, I didn't go seek out people that I knew weren't, I didn't go seek out people that I knew weren't waiting to talk to me, or something to that effect. He did not gather information from each and every witness at the scene, but the witnesses I spoke to, I knew were witnesses, were gathered up in the corner of the parking lot of the 7-Eleven. I didn't go out and try to speak to everyone who was walking around. And I think that created a false impression, which I'll get to in a minute. But I think that that also indicates that he was trying to portray that he spoke to all the witnesses that waited to talk to him that were at that area. But from the way that it appears in State's Exhibit 32 and 17, one of which is the edited and one is not, so obviously I have to listen to the unedited one to hear all this, but it's fairly obvious that he's referring to other witnesses that no one took information from, I think. Did that...
Yes.
Okay.
That's right. My question. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Anyway, back to the corroborating evidence. I think one of the things I didn't put in the brief that is also important is that I think Brighton...
Didn't put it in the brief?
Well, okay, let me back up. It's in there, but I didn't explain it well enough. How about that? I'm sorry.
Goodness gracious.
No, that is definitely not the proper way to do that. I'm sure that Mr. Orbison would not be jumping to my defense if that were the case, as in the last party. But no. One of the things I don't think that I expound on enough when I talk about the cooperation is I say something about the fact that I think that Michael Brighton, who is the traffic supervisor who testified to the lights, whether or not the lights worked, he explained and testified that to how they checked the lights. So they checked the southbound indicators. He said that they didn't check the controller for the 30 days preceding the accident or the 30 days around it. So I think that there is some cooperation with his testimony that maybe the light wasn't functioning, even though I know that the state would say that his is dead on that it was functioning, because I don't think that it was indicated that he did everything to check every possibility that would exclude that the light was not malfunctioning. Additionally, he gave some testimony that if, in fact, Mr. Moll had been traveling at the rate of speed that the eyewitnesses who gave affidavits said that he was traveling, that he would have crossed through the intersection no problem before the light ever turned to red. And I think that may be some corroboration as well for the fact that these other witnesses said the light was not red when Mr. Moll entered the intersection. So I
have a question, just a factual question that I wasn't sure from reading the briefs. The Mrs. Jentgen?
Yes.
Did she turn left in front of the Cordis car? She was already through the intersection in front. Okay.
That is the impression that I get, because she says, and I don't know that it's completely clear on the way that it comes. I think actually not very much is completely clear from this record. But I think that the way that she testifies, she indicates that she was turning left already, and from Mr. Cordis's testimony, that he, as he was approaching the light, he says it turned green, so he didn't have to stop. And he was saying the other car was in front of him, and she said she heard the noise behind her. I didn't get very far at all. So one thing I do want to point out also is that the state made some argument that the defensive theory for Mr. Moll was actually that the cop was bad. I want to say that's a plan B thing. I mean, it's obvious from this that the trial attorney was relentless in trying to get in this evidence about the other eyewitnesses, and that was what he was saying by asking for the causation issues and everything else that he did throughout the entirety of the trial indicated that he was trying to say this is what was the intervening cause and this is the defense. The fact that he had to attack Van Dyke so strongly was sort of his backup, because if you can't get the evidence in, the only thing that you can do is attack the reason the evidence can't be brought in, which was because the officer didn't really investigate, didn't talk to all the witnesses, and didn't do his job. So, yes, that's what it appears that the defense's theory ends up having to be, but I think that it's very clear that was not the theory that the defense wanted to present. That was what they were left with.
Thank you, Ms. Moore. And Mr. Orbison.
May it please the court. I think the record ought to reflect when Dawn was talking about the unintelligent people, she was pointing at me, and I objected to that. I disagree with opposing counsel. I think it is fairly obvious. I wish it were more obvious in the record, Justice Walker, but to me at least, and I know we differ on this, to me it's fairly obvious that Gloria Castillo and her companions were the three people. Because the statement, and you can, I'm not sure I filed a motion to transfer the unedited videotape, but if I didn't, this court certainly can, and I encourage it to. This is, I had three people listed. I'm pretty sure this is correctly transcribed. What Heidemeyer actually said and what all the fight was over, he said, three people that are over here, I don't know what you want from them other than these affidavits, but they are sitting here. None of them are very intelligent individuals, which is about par for the course, but they're saying the light was yellow going to red when he made his turn, the expedition. And Van Dyke says, okay. And then Heinemeier says, and so what I was hearing from them is that they were guaranteeing it was red. So you know how that goes. So there are several clues there. Gloria Castillo, in her affidavit, was the only one that incorrectly stated the expedition was making a turn. It wasn't. It was going straight through the intersection on Hebron, and I don't believe opposing counsel will dispute that. The statement says, other than these affidavits. Now, maybe it was the other affidavits that he's holding in his hand or giving to the trooper. I don't know. But it certainly could be the included in the affidavits that are there. Also, Ms. Castillo is the only one that said the light was going to red in her affidavit. So it sure seems to me that what we have over here is Gloria Castillo and two of her traveling companions for the night. But the record is not going to show conclusively that. And even though what it might be obvious to me, it certainly isn't obvious to opposing counsel, and I certainly understand that. There was another, Justice Walker asked another question that I thought I would contribute my two cents. What we had here is the Jenkins car that was going northbound on Marsh, taking a left onto westbound Hebron. And then we had the Cordes car that was going southbound on Marsh, taking a left, going eastbound on Hebron. It happened, perhaps the Jenkins car was slightly ahead of the Cordes car, but not much, because her testimony was she was in the middle of the intersection. Well, that's where the Cordes car was struck, in the middle of the intersection. And she also testified that she thought she had been hit because I think she described it as air from the impact or something, but she initially thought her car had been struck. So it was really a situation where the cars were about like this when the first car gets struck, is how I interpret the record there. As to opposing counsel's point that Ms. Castillo's affidavit could be more accurate than her in-court testimony, and I concede that your observations at the time of an event are probably going to be fresher and perhaps more accurate than later. That's not always the case, but I concede that can be the case. But here, there was no testimony that her concession by Ms. Castillo that her testimony was different from her affidavit. What she was doing was clarifying what she had written, not that she had changed her mind or not that it was different than she had said in her affidavit, but she was simply clarifying what she had written in her affidavit. I think she wrote he was trying to make the light as it was going to red. And so the question in the trial was, well, did he make it? Oh, no, he didn't make it. It was red, but her affidavit said he was trying to make it before it went to red. In other words, she was really talking about the state of the mind of the appellant as he was driving that night. That's about as far as opposing counsel got. I guess there's more to come in the time she has left, so I'll just say that the state is not going to say that we had a trooper here with a lot of credibility. That's why the state, I think, rather scrupulously avoided using the trooper, avoided using any investigation that he might have conducted. later introduced testimony that there was no need in a case like this for accident reconstruction and all the other jargon that was discussed at trial that defense counsel attempted to muddy the waters with. The state simply did not use Van Dyke as a crucial witness. There were certain things that were established through his testimony, and I outlined those fairly in fair detail, I think, in the brief. But the state was not resting its case on Van Dyke at all. We had five strong eyewitnesses that were traveling on the same road in the same direction as the appellant, and they were all in agreement that his driving was beyond erratic. It was not beyond just swerving, beyond just speeding, but it was there was a jerkiness to it. There was he would swerve from one lane to the other and then almost hit the car in front of me before he would stop and then swerve into another lane. In fact, Ms. Costello herself testified that earlier on Hebron Parkway, he almost hit her. And had she not moved her car in a way, an evasive way, that he would have struck her. So clearly there was strong evidence of intoxication. There was strong evidence that he ran a red light. In fact, in my view, and I, of course, counsel, I would expect her to not agree, but in my view, there was conclusive evidence that the light was red. And here it is. The expert testimony said it is impossible. It is impossible for the north and south lights to be green and the east and westbound be other thing than red and for at least 2 seconds. And since they got so far into the intersection, we're probably talking more like 4 seconds of red before the cars got to where they were at the time of the impact. And he even testified that we try to give the lights that scenario. We try to say, make everything green, and it won't because it immediately goes to flashing red. And there was no flashing red in this case. And even on the tape, you can see the lights are cycling, even 30, 40 minutes. Well, one other point that reminded me about these three witnesses saying the light was going to red. First, the obvious is that nobody said it was green. Nobody said it was yellow. These are three witnesses that say the light's yellow going to red, which is kind of strange in and of itself, but be that as it may, they were not there. They did not come forward when all the other witnesses did, and that was the testimony of the officer. He said they came up later after the other witnesses had already filled out their affidavits, after Trooper Van Dyke had been on the scene. Sometime after that is when they came up and said, light's going to red. So that, to me, cast a little suspicion on them as well. And I don't want to make giant leaps from the record. And I don't want to, but since counsel said, well, what we've got out here is disinterested witnesses just waiting to speak to the police officers, I'm not sure the record supports that. We do know that the appellant made a phone call after the impact, before his arrest. He called June, I don't recall the last name, but she testified. She said he called, and the reason the testimony the witnesses was called by the defense so she could testify that he sounded concerned but normal in speech. That was the reason the testimony was admitted. But isn't it kind of strange that he made a call after the accident and while the investigation was going on? I found that a little strange. When you add that to the testimony of the officer saying they came up later, is it beyond the stretch of imagination to think that he might have called somebody down there to say, go tell him the light was yellow? I'm not saying that happened. I don't want to offend opposing counsel or this court. I'm just saying that it's not clear to me that we have disinterested citizens waiting for their chance to talk. If there are any questions based on the state's brief, I would gladly entertain them at this time. With hearing none, I pray this court would affirm the judgment below. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Orbison. Ms. Moore?
Well, I want to say, to begin with, if we had three affidavits saying the lights was yellow going to red, well, then where are they? I mean, wow, that seems even better than anything I've got if they didn't give us the affidavits that said the light was yellow going to red, because all we have is one witness that says something that could be construed as that. So obviously, if they took three affidavits from three witnesses saying that, which we know they didn't because they said they didn't do it.
Why don't you proceed to a harm analysis on this particular issue?
Okay.
Because I'm not sure that you get there in the harm analysis.
Well, I think we have to look at it from a constitutional standpoint to begin with. And in looking at that, it was the sole defensive issue. And I think that the applicability or applying the statute, the hearsay statute, in a way that excluded this credible, reliable evidence that I might also point out, and I'll get to the harm analysis, but I might also point out only the state had the chance to cross-examine the declarants of the hearsay, and they had a full opportunity to do that through interviewing those witnesses and talking to them about what they saw at the scene. So it almost seems like a clean hands sort of argument to me, too, in the fact that, you know, they're the ones who are the reason we don't have the evidence, and then they don't let it in because of the technical letter of the law, which I understand we argue the technical letter of the law all the time, but we also need to look at the spirit of the law. And the point of the constitutional protections that we allow is to make sure that people get an opportunity to present their defensive theories. And I would say the harm here in particular can also be seen by looking at the jury charge requests. I think it was almost impossible for defense counsel in this case to get the causation charge without being able to present enough evidence to support that. I mean, I do think that there was evidence to support the lesser included offense and the causation charge based on what the standard is. But I think in particular it was extremely harmful not to be able to have that evidence to support the defensive theory and thus not being able to obtain a charge on that, the causation charge, because of the exclusion of that evidence. So I think that harm was there on that aspect. And then also, like I said before, I think there was just sort of a bad faith thing to this. But I know that the state points out that they don't think that it went to all four manners and means, whether or not the light was functioning properly or whether it was yellow going to red. I think it absolutely does. Because if you look at what they allege, they say running the red light, failing to yield, failing to avoid the collision and excessive speed. Well, all of those things could potentially be countered with the malfunction of the light, with the light actually being yellow, not red. And in particular, there was some counter about the speed based on the testimony of Brighton, which also I want to point out that the testimony of Brighton actually said that the lights all go to flashing because it won't allow two opposing movements. That doesn't mean that the lights might not be malfunctioning and the flashing wouldn't come on. If the lights were short cycling and you weren't getting the full 4 seconds or 2 seconds, the lights wouldn't necessarily come on, and it could still cause just as much problem in the way that the testimony came out about how he would have had to be proceeding through the intersection with that. I also want to just point out, under the rule of optional completeness, one of the things that we look at is, are we creating a false impression? And that is one of my big problems with this. Van Dyke and Heinemeier, the state, through their argument, and here's another aspect of the harm analysis. The state, through their argument, encouraged the false impression that Van Dyke had presented, because they basically said, all the witnesses said this. You heard Mr. Meyer. He got up there and said that you were going to hear that some of the witnesses said the light was yellow, and you didn't hear that. And by emphasizing that, the other prosecutor also said two statements. You heard from all the witnesses that the light was red, and you heard from all the witnesses at the scene that testified, which indicated to me like he was referring to both groups. So I think that that also went to emphasizing the harm of that testimony being excluded. But in particular, I think that it just smacks of impropriety. It just seems wrong. And I know that that may be more of an equitable than going over Sub's particular case law here, but if all the case law dealing with optional completeness seems to center on that notion. Hey, we shouldn't allow you to ask about the portable breath test and whether or not it gave a valid result, and then not ask what the result is, because that implies that the result might have been in your favor. It creates the misimpression that the jury wonders why they didn't hear the rest of the evidence. And I think that that's what occurred here by the way that Van Dyke presented that testimony when he was cross-examined in direct. I pray that you reverse for all the reasons listed in the brief. Thank you very much.
All the reasons listed in the brief? The 85-page brief? Mr. Moore, Ms. Moore, Mr. Orbison, as always, it's good to have both of you here this morning, and we appreciate your arguments. It's an interesting issue. Case is submitted. We'll ask the clerk to adjourn us since we haven't.